Good morning. It's time for In the Green Outdoors with Gail Martin and Carol Kelly. Each week, the ladies will bring you gardening and planting ideas, tell you about native Ohio plants, prairies and habitats, and great tips for everything in the green outdoors. This week with Carol Kelly.
Hello again, everyone. Well, June had us alternating between scorching hot temperatures and pouring rain. Remains to be seen what July has in store for us. We've all heard the warnings for humans and pets regarding heat stress. Such warnings must be taken to heart. According to the National Safety Council, last year, 39 children died from heat stroke after being left in a vehicle. So far this year, 13 deaths have been reported. How any parent or caregiver can forget or ignore that they have a child with them is beyond me, and this occurs even more often with pets. But these tragedies are beyond the purview of In the Green Outdoors. Heat stress in plants, on the other hand, while nowhere nearly as serious, is definitely of concern to gardeners. So let me begin my segment today by offering a few tips about that. Most plants grow best in temperatures ranging from 59 degrees to 86 degrees Fahrenheit. When temperatures above 90 degrees Fahrenheit are sustained for long periods, plant growth is slowed and some plants begin to show signs of stress. Above 104 degrees Fahrenheit, many plants will survive but will show different signs of heat stress depending on plant type, maturity of the plant, and factors that often come with high temperatures, such as drought or wind. Extreme air and soil temperatures slow down chemical activity and growth in plants. Recently, a day after I had watered my vegetable garden pretty well, we had a good rain that added another inch of water to my raised bed vegetable garden, and that meant it was a perfect time to mulch everything with a couple of inches of dried and shredded leaves that I had kept just for that purpose since last fall. Not only does such mulch help retain moisture in the soil, it also keeps the soil itself at a moderate temperature. Various plants react in various ways to heat stress. Corn and tomatoes may roll up or cup their leaves. Tomato pollen and other kinds of pollen, including rice and canola, are sensitive to extreme heat. Even when humidity is low, if the temperature is high enough, the heat will render tomato pollen sterile, or else the pollen in the blossoms may clump up and not fall onto the pistils, which is necessary, of course, for pollination to occur. Fortunately, this only becomes a problem during extreme, persistent heat waves. Plants often wilt in the heat of day, but recover somewhat overnight. The potential for permanent damage increases with the length of time that a plant remains wilted. On just the occasional day, when a high temperature reaches 95 degrees or more, the overnight temperature still is likely to be 10 to 20 degrees cooler. The current two-week forecast going out from this present hot weekend is predicting highs in the mid-80s, with overnight lows in the mid-60s, so for now, plants, including tomatoes, should stay in pretty good shape, assuming they are watered regularly, either by the gardener or Mother Nature. Rainfall over the period I mentioned is the usual scattered or isolated type, and you know how that can go. So to complete my thought, it's when a high temperature is sustained for a full 24-hour day that the flowers never really have a window in which the pollen reaches the pistil. Once the flower opens, there's only a day or two of opportunity for pollination. When it does occur, the flowers begin to shrivel up and the little tomato forms within. If pollination does not take place, the flower simply drops off. By the way, smaller tomato varieties seem to be more tolerant to heat. Cherry tomatoes and those varieties that produce just golf ball-sized salad tomatoes fare much better than do the huge slicer types. Numerous ornamentals abort or drop buds and flowers after prolonged exposure to high temperatures as well. This allows the plants to conserve resources for parts of the plant that are necessary for survival. Blossom and fruit drop are common in peppers, squash, and cucumbers when high temperatures persist. Most plants will return to typical production after a heat wave is over. a common tomato problem, which occasionally may include peppers and eggplant, since they're all in the same nightshade family, is blossom end rot. This is associated with a lack of calcium in the soil, along with inconsistent watering. Avoid letting plants dry out completely before watering. The goal is to keep soil evenly moist. Again, mulch helps here. A survival mechanism used by some plant types is that the outer margins of a leaf will dry up, but the leaf as a whole remains viable. This may be more common in large leaf plants like squash and pumpkin, where there's more leaf surface area to spare and still maintain function. Dry leaf edges can appear similar to disease symptoms. Bolting refers to the premature flowering of plants before they typically would be harvested. Since high temperatures induce bolting in cool season vegetables, a heat wave likely will mean pretty much the end for plants like cilantro, broccoli, cauliflower, bok choy, lettuce, spinach, and other such plants. For the best quality and flavor, it may be helpful to harvest these foods when a heat wave is predicted. However, only appearance and possibly taste is affected. The plants themselves are perfectly safe to eat. Many fruits will scald in high temperatures, primarily on the side of the fruit, of course, most exposed to the sun. Bear in mind here that the word fruit is a botanical term and includes things we commonly think of as vegetables, for example, all the cucurbits and nightshades. Sun scald looks different depending on the fruit. It may appear as a watery or discolored patch, blistered skin, or dried out, sunken, or hardened areas on the fruit surface. Speaking of the heat and rainfall, I also want to add a reminder to check your yard for anything that may contain standing water, whether it be in watering cans, wheelbarrows, rain barrels, old tires. Hopefully you do not have tires lying about, but you are recycling these properly. I have several sets of wire shelves in my lightly shaded garden work area in the backyard, on which I put flats of plants when I move them from my grow lights in the basement into the outdoors so they may acclimate and grow on a bit before I plant them in the ground. A few weeks ago, I noticed that I had left behind a plastic salad container that I had used under a cell pack of zinnias until I got them planted, and I'd forgotten to take it indoors. After a rain, it had accumulated several inches of rainwater, and when I noticed it, I saw the container also was full of tiny wriggling mosquito larvae. Of course, I immediately flushed the water down a drain and then checked around the yard to be sure that there were no other such containers anywhere. I store gallon jugs of water to use when watering my young plants that are still in flats, but those all have screw-on lids, and I only pour water into my watering cans that I use when I'm ready to use it, and then always empty them. We have had a small patch of standing water in our yard recently, output from our basement sump pump, but we're considering options for correcting the problem. In the meantime, I have dropped half of a mosquito dunk into the small but persistent puddle. Mosquitoes are out in force, and in this hot weather, the females quickly take advantage of any still water in which to lay their eggs. And not only water, but also mud. Their life cycle typically takes up to 2 weeks after eggs are deposited, but depending on conditions, it can range from as few as 4 days or take as long as a month. From time to time, as the season advances, I like to bring attention to just a few of the various wildflowers that appear roadside. The yellow flowers of wild parsnip and the white ones of poison hemlock mostly have faded as they have begun to ripen their seeds. I warned listeners some weeks ago about the necessity of avoiding both of these highly toxic alien invasive plants, and that warning still stands. Although their bloom period has passed, the maturing foliage is no less toxic. If you have any on your property, it's vital that you wear pretty much the equivalent of a hazmat suit to deal with eliminating it, a task that definitely should be done before the seeds ripen yet another generation. Although, of course, there are still countless seeds remaining viable in the ground around there that are waiting to replace any plants that are destroyed. It's an ongoing battle. Bright orange daylilies, commonly called ditch lilies, have been blooming for a number of weeks now. All parts of this invasive Asian plant are edible at different times of the year. Just gather them from someplace other than a dirty roadside ditch. These plants are not true lilies. They do not grow from bulbs, but rather from small marble-sized tubers that may be dug when the ground has thawed in early spring and eaten raw or cooked. The young leaves may be cut as they emerge, washed well, and eaten raw or steamed. The buds and flowers are what are ready for harvest now. I like to snack on the smaller buds when I'm out in the garden, or I'll let them get a bit larger, then steam them lightly until tender but not soggy. Add some butter and a few dashes of lemon pepper or whatever seasoning you like and enjoy. If you miss the bud stage, the flowers may be used, either chopped fresh in salads, stuffed with any one of the various types of cheeses like ricotta, cream cheese, or goat cheese, then dipped in a light batter and quickly fried. In Asian countries where they originated, the mature dried flowers are added to soup as a thickener, rather as we might add okra to gumbo. Now, while I do not allow bright orange daylilies in my backyard, my neighbor has quite a few of them, and he has given me permission to help myself to the buds. Before we turned the calendar over to July, I had noticed that Queen Anne's lace already was beginning to bloom in meadows and waste areas along the roadsides, often interspersed with the rigid stems of sky blue chicory. Both of these plants are edible as well. Parts of both have been consumed and or used medicinally by people on several continents for thousands of years. However, like hemlock and parsnip, neither of these plants are native to North America, but came with the early settlers and colonists. I'm also seeing native fleabane, a rather lanky plant topped with small daisy-like flowers, and various kinds of milkweed with pink to purple flowers. The weedy and aggressive common milkweed, Sullivan's milkweed, and swamp milkweed. And then there's butterfly weed, also a milkweed, but a rather lower growing variety with eye-catching clusters of bright orange flowers. I also saw teasels standing stiffly above the lower grasses and weeds all along Route 23 the other day. They are not quite blooming yet. Maybe I'll discuss this in my next segment. There's a lot of birdfoot trefoil all along the pavement of many roadsides, and then the tall, loose branches of yellow and white meadow sweet wave in the breeze of passing cars. As you travel through Marion and the surrounding counties, be sure to notice the changing palette of colors of our roadside wildflowers, whether native or not. Hoverflies are perhaps the most numerous tiny insects that attend the dill, cilantro, and my bolting bok choy, and other plants that put forth tiny flowers in my yard, including the wildflowers such as the fleabane I mentioned. Hoverflies go by several other names, including surfed flies, flower flies, and drone flies, and are a common sight everywhere. Hoverflies are true flies and harmless to humans, although they do look like small bees or wasps. As the name implies, they often are seen hovering in the air, darting a short distance, and then hovering again. It's not unusual for one to land on my arm when I'm in the yard. They're attracted to the salty sweat on my skin. These beneficial insects are valuable allies in the fight against aphids, thrips, scale insects, and caterpillars, and are nearly as effective as ladybugs and lacewings at controlling aphids. A well-established population of hoverfly larvae can control 70 to 80% of an aphid infestation. Although they are most efficient at controlling aphids, they do also help control other soft-bodied insects. The adults feed on nectar as they pollinate the flowers. The female lays her tiny, creamy white eggs near aphid colonies. The larvae emerge hungry in just 3 or 4 days and begin feeding on any aphids present immediately. After spending several days eating aphids, the larvae each attach themselves to a stem and build a tiny cocoon. They spend 10 days or so inside the cocoon during warm weather, a little longer when the weather is cool. The flies emerge from the cocoons, and the cycle begins again. Well, time is flying. I really jumped around to various topics today, but there's a lot to keep track of in summer. This is Carol Kelly reminding you to take time to observe the interaction of everything around us, since there is so very much to see here in the green outdoors.
And there's your show for the week. In the Green Outdoors is a production of WZMO Radio. The show airs Saturdays and Mondays right after the second cup at about 9:30 a.m. If you have a question or comment for Carol or Gail, you can email it to WZMO@roadrunner.com. Thank you for listening.